Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This week, linguist David J. Peterson, that's right, the linguist who invented High Valyrian and Dothraki. He's done work for the MCU, and he specializes in inventing fictional languages, but making their grammar and syntax work within the universe. Very few people in the world can do what he does, and I appreciate it greatly. David and I cover Tyrion's second POV chapter. Steve and I will continue our rewatch of Season 2 as we look at Garden of Bones. Just a quick note on our Manscaped ad. I just want you to know that Steve was not aware that I was going to be reading that ad. I sprung it on him. So everything he says during that ad read is totally impromptu. And I found it highly entertaining. I know it's 7 minutes long, but man, we go all out for our ad partners here at Electric Boogaloo. Bird's Eye View this week. Rather than just monologuing, I do a little interview with a friend of mine, Chris Keith, who is an expert on ancient book culture. Without further ado, here is Boss Man Aaron.
Ask Aaron anything!
Aaron, from The Expanse, we know that one of the key actors is going to go bye-bye at the end of the season.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say you can you have all the power to recast that actor, but you have to choose an actor from Game of Thrones.
Oh, done. I mean, have you seen the Kingsman like sequel? Pedro Pascal with a drawling Southern accent and a cowboy hat with a whip. I mean, that's a massive upgrade. Yeah, I mean, there's no way you get Pedro Pascal because he's got like, you know, Game of Thrones and Mando money now.
He's got Wonder Woman money now.
He's got Wonder Woman money. He's got Kingsman money. He doesn't need your silly space opera, but he would be an amazing Alex. Holy shit, yeah. He'd be an amazing Alex.
He would be great. He'd be great. Right? That's good. That's good. See, this is what I'm talking about.
Because I'm trying to think if there's any other characters of like kind of East Asian. And that's the thing is Pedro Pascal wouldn't be East Asian. He'd be kind of like South American playing as East Asian. There weren't a lot of East Asian characters on Game of Thrones, right? Like Dr. Bashir,
I don't know. I always thought he was Latino, but I could be wrong about that. Spanish. Is he Spanish?
Sadiq? With the last name of Sadiq? He's got to be.
I don't know. That's a good question. He could be Middle Eastern. Be a Spaniard because there's.
He's from the Sudan. He's African.
Oh, I had no idea.
So yeah, that's not exactly, but but the thing is he's just, I don't think Alexander Siddig is a great character actor. I don't think he would do great for Alex. He doesn't have that bombacity.
You kind of need that sort of young, brash. You need a kind of guy that wants to go hang out in a cowboy bar and really enjoy it.
And he's also gone to sea. That's crucial to the. He can't be like a 20-year-old. It needs to be, you know, late 30s, 40s, even early 50s if you can get it.
Interesting. Okay. So, hey, everybody, if you're not watching The Expanse, you gotta tune in.
Pretty good show.
If you have a question for Aaron or Anthony, you can send those to book@baldmove.com.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering the Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwais is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
David, I'd like to start with a game. You'd be afraid of playing a game with me?
Always.
Okay. This is a game called Overrated, Underrated, or Properly Rated. It's pretty simple. I throw out a topic, and you tell me what you think about it.
Okay, sounds good.
All right, so your three categories are overrated, underrated, or properly rated. Tacos.
Oh, brother. You know, I have to say, at least from where I'm from, properly rated. I mean, a taco is just a fantastic thing. It's a simple thing, and I think people are coming to appreciate that more and more, that a taco can be anything. It needs a tortilla, probably, and something inside, but otherwise it doesn't need to be as restrictive. And I really
Are you originally from San Diego, or did you just spend some time in San Diego?
I'm originally, actually, I was born in Long Beach.
Okay.
So, but originally from Southern California. I lived all my life in Southern California, outside from 4 years at Berkeley and 1 year in Fresno. And of course, my my family, at least my mother's family, is from Mexico. So we grew up with Mexican food. And I'm really proud that somebody like Gustavo Arellano has come out and kind of rescued the taco, because, you know, it's one thing where people on one hand think, oh, it's just cheap, it's nothing. And then somebody comes out and says, well, tacos, they're actually really special and they always have to be this way. I think Gustavo Arellano, he has really nailed it as far as what the taco means. And I think we're there. So yeah, properly rated.
Okay. Now, this may be geographically specific, because you're saying, as a native Southern Californian,
yes,
who has roots in Mexico,
yes,
the taco is properly rated, but you may have a different opinion of that had you lived or spent, you know, considerable time somewhere else in the world.
Well, I will say this. I have been to Mexican restaurants in places like Texas and Missouri and have experienced some of the worst food I have ever eaten in my entire life.
these are fighting words. Texans are really excited about their Mexican food.
They don't have Mexican food. They have something called Tex-Mex, which is a food all its own and is distantly related to Mexican food, much the way, say, that, I don't know,
Phoenician and Hebrew are related.
I have to say it's more distant than that. It's kind of like maybe like Dutch and Proto-Indo-European. You know, there's been a lot of.
Oh, geez. You know what? I've had wonderful mole in Texas, but it could have just been my experience.
I will have to take your word on that.
You will
mole,
have to take
come
my
on.
Word. Yeah, no, you will have to take my word on that. Underrated, overrated, or properly rated diphthongs.
Overrated, highly overrated. I really despise diphthongs. Diphthongs in the traditional sense, which is that you know, starts as one vowel, ends in another as another, but treated as one vowel. I hate them. I absolutely hate them.
You know, I don't even like the word. I do not like the phonetic feel of that word at all.
It's very uncomfortable to have to say diphthong as opposed to diphthong.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
It's not pleasant, but yeah, English,
it's an uncomfortable pushing together of syllables in the word, which almost bespeaks the word.
I know, and like there's no diphthongs in it. We should be at least pronouncing it, you know, diphthong or something.
Yeah, right.
But no, right. terrible. English is one of the worst. Dutch, I still can never wrap my head around. And have you heard how they say the word no in Britain? It's got like five vowels in it.
Nine. Yeah, I lived in Britain for a number of years, and I still don't know how many vowels are in the word no.
Atrocious. Don't like it. Anyway, overrated.
Okay, overrated, underrated, or properly rated, Thor, The Dark World.
You asked me that.
You know what? Let me preface this. I was going to mess with you. I know that you worked on that movie. And I was going to mess with you. And then I was thinking about it. I was thinking, you know, that movie actually is probably underrated because trolled so much. And if you sit down and just like, you know, you divorce it a little bit from the MCU and just watch it as a film without the expectations of some of the other films, it's watchable. It is a watchable movie.
Yeah, I would definitely say underrated. So, I mean, from my experience, there were a lot of things that had to be cut out of the script, which would have made it better. But however, even so, I mean, I don't know what it is with people in Marvel movies. I mean, sure, there are good ones, right? I mean, Endgame was great, but like, what do you need? I mean, it's Chris Hemsworth. He's very charming, very, very attractive, very entertaining. Loki is there. It's fun.
It's a fun movie. I thought it was genuinely funny in a few ways that I was not expecting. I would recommend listeners give it another try. You know, it's not Ragnarok, but give it another try.
Yes. Thanks.
All right. Now, we're going to be covering Tyrion's second POV chapter. And I think this chapter does the most so far to intermingle the themes of ice and fire. All right. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to do a quick synopsis of the chapter, and then we can fill in any gaps in our conversation.
Okay.
This is a Tyrion POV chapter. In it, we learn about the geography of the North between Winterfell and the Wall. We also learn about Tyrion's internal landscape, the contours of his thoughts, interests, and his regard for Jon Snow. From his view, Jon is coming to a harder realization that the Night's Watch is populated by scoundrels, and that he was a fool to think otherwise. We learn of Tyrion's budding rivalry with Benjen Stark, his love of dragon lore, and his relentless bookishness. We hear of Aegon's conquest, some of the history of Westeros, and the various uses of dragonbone. Tyrion and Jon have a conversation about books, bastards, and beasts. After Tyrion teases Jon and angers him, Ghost upends Tyrion. Eventually, Jon and Tyrion share a laugh about it and return to camp for some squirrel stew and more of Tyrion's wine. That's my synopsis. How'd I do?
Oh, well enough. Yeah.
All right.
Sounds good to me.
Good. All right. So, guest choice. Would you, David, like to talk about a character, a plot point, a theme, or shall we just climb the ladder of chaos together?
I was going to say Tyrion, but on the other hand, climbing the ladder of chaos just sounds so much fun, doesn't it?
It could. The ladder could include Tyrion.
I mean, one would assume.
It's a great Tyrion chapter, and I find it interesting because it reveals a lot about Jon Snow. And I think that one of the previous Jon Snow chapters reveals a lot about Tyrion. So these two are kind of sort of reflecting off each other a little bit.
Yeah, I'm just going to come out and say at the outset, I don't care about Jon Snow as a character at all.
Really?
I don't find him very interesting on his own. The only time that Jon Snow is interesting to me is when he is interacting with specific people. And at the top of my list is Tyrion. So that's why this for me, you know, because the early days when I was reading this for the first time, that was really, this was really a fun chapter for me because I really liked what I got from their interaction. I also love him interacting with Arya. It's also good. And, him interacting with Catelyn is fun as well.
I think any scene Tyrion's in or any chapter that Tyrion's in is going to be interesting with very few exceptions. And I think that you almost need a character like Jon Snow or at least a few characters like Jon Snow so that a character like Tyrion can really shine.
I want to go. Well, all right. I was eventually going to get here, but I'm going to go ahead and jump. Yes. So I'll say yes at the outset. If you have a more, and I really don't want to offend people who love Jon Snow, but I was going to say, if you have a more wooden character like Jon Snow,
sure,
it helps because then Tyrion does indeed get to do some really fun stuff, like with Jorah.
Yeah, Jorah. That's right. That's right. Now, but, in John's defense, okay, he's 14, and he's certainly not fully developed. And I think he will. I think he will become more interesting as the story progresses. But you know, I think he's half baked at this point. That's my
opinion. But I also I will say, like, I also liked the early bits with Jon Snow coming to the wall, because you kind of get, you know, a little bitty mini Hogwarts there.
Yeah, sure.
and Jon interacting with a bunch of, you know, a bunch of very salty characters that we haven't seen him interact with. We haven't seen him interact with that type of person previously. So I enjoyed that too. So that can be fun. But should I jump to this already? Okay, fine. I'm going to jump to this. So going back to Tyrion, though, it is a lot of fun to essentially see Tyrion get the opportunity to tee off on people, because essentially he's often the Groucho Marx and everybody else is his straight man. Right. You know, he is almost always, because that's what we're getting to, but he's always the smartest person in the room. He's always the funniest person in the room and the most incisive wit. And really the only way anybody can gainsay him is to do like what Ghost did, basically to physically overpower him.
Sure.
Because they can't beat him at wits. However, there is one person that can, and those are my favorite parts of the entire series. And those are scenes with Tyrion and Tywin. Huh. Because that is the only time you ever seen Tyrion completely outmatched. And that makes his character interesting, because it's a ton of fun. It's a ton of fun to see, you know, Tyrion just, you know, snapping one-liners off and getting one over people, even people that he grows to respect, like Jon. But there really are no scenes in that entire series like Tyrion and Tywin, where you get somebody who is really smart, really witty, who is still getting outmatched at every step, and not physically, but mentally. And it really puts his character to the test. And it just, I don't know, it lights up my brain. Those interactions, they're so intense. I love them.
So let me ask you this. Given that Tyrion's something of a heavyweight when it comes to dialogue, and that Jon suffers the dialogue problems that most the Stark adjacent men do. Do you think that Tyrion is bullying Jon? Do you think that he's doing Jon a favor, or is it both?
Oh no, it's absolutely both. You don't want to go so far as to say bullying, but I mean, essentially, yeah, that's what's happening. He's kind of, Jon is outmatched, and Tyrion is having a little bit of fun with him. However, it doesn't go too far. I mean, obviously, in Jon's opinion, it does go too far. But you know, as they kind of make up afterwards, he realizes that, you know, actually Tyrion was speaking truly, and perhaps Tyrion, you know, just assumed that what he was telling him was common knowledge, essentially. What he was telling him about the Night's Watch was common knowledge, but it wasn't to Jon.
So I'm going to read this little portion here. I just think it's brilliant writing.
Sure.
All right, so stop it, Jon Snow said, his face dark with anger. The Night's Watch is a noble calling. Tyrion laughed. You are too smart to believe that. The Night's Watch is a midden heap for all of the misfits of the realm. I've seen you looking at Yorn and his boys. Those are your new brothers, Jon Snow. How do you like them? Sullen peasants, debtors, poachers, rapers, thieves, and bastards like you all wind up at the wall, watching for Grumpkins and Snarks and all the other monsters your wet nurse warned you about. The good part is there are no Grumpkins or Snarks, so it's scarcely dangerous work. The bad part is that you freeze your balls off, but since you're not allowed to breed anyway, I don't suppose that matters. So, I mean, he's laying it on thick. And then, of course, right after that, Ghost kind of settles the argument, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he's sort If there's such a thing as sort of mind bullying, I think that's what's happening here. I think that Tyrion knows it afterwards. He feels a little bit guilty that he lays it on so thick afterwards.
You know, this may be biased talking because, of course, we just as readers, you can't help but grow to love Tyrion,
of course,
and root for him. But I feel like when I'm reading that, he's laying it on thick, but I feel like he is at the same time commiserating and going over, you know, something that Jon should know. Whereas, like, I want you to imagine that speech. It would be delivered differently. But I want you to imagine Tywin being there instead of Tyrion. And him being quite direct and quite honest about what Jon was doing and his lot in life. There would be no warmth or humor there. It would take on a very different tone, and it would, I mean, especially given his political power, would be very frightening. Tyrion always has, it's an odd to think about this as a strength, but essentially in his back pocket, he always has his physical weakness in that, like, you know, basically he knows that at any point in time, anybody could shut him up if they wanted to. I think that he kind of assumes that is in the common ground at all times. I don't know. So I don't read it as straight bullying, but I will admit that there may indeed be bias there because, you know, you are supposed to like this character.
I think you're supposed to like him. I think that there's also something about Tyrion where he walks into every room already swinging verbally.
Yeah.
Like he knows there's going to be someone in that room that's going to make some stupid joke that he's heard 1,000 times. And he just decides, you know, I'm going to come in swinging. I'm going to come in and lay down the law with an insult or some witty self-deprecating humor or something like that so that people know what they're dealing with, that they know that they're dealing with a warhammer of a mind. And
yes.
I think that can, I mean, maybe despite himself, maybe he does it too much because he's expecting a war of words from the get-go. But boy, it's great to read. I mean, you wouldn't necessarily want to like share an office cubicle with Tyrion, but boy, he's fun to read on the page.
I think it's also a bit of a youngest sibling syndrome in if you imagine, like, you know, any sort of meeting or get together or whatever, nobody's saying, "Oh, hey, was Tyrion there?"
Exactly.
You know, he's in the room. You know, you're not going to pass him over. And I think that's probably something he's consciously or unconsciously always aiming for.
And he knows he kind of walks around with a spotlight on him, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So he's going to make the most of it. I want to talk about just for a moment, about Tyrion's drinking. Tyrion, you get the sense he drinks a lot of wine, right? So that's okay. That's fine. And then you realize how much, like, he's brought his wine all the way from Casterly Rock. And I get the sense that for the amount of drinking that he's doing, he just has barrels and barrels of wine. And then I realize, okay, so it's 8 men traveling, but they're traveling with 20 horses. I mean, how many of these horses are carrying Tyrion's wine? I mean, he's sharing the wine. That's fine. But oh my gosh, are you? I have this image of Tyrion and 7 companions riding up the King's Road. And then there's maybe 10 horses that are just carrying barrels of wine. That's the image I'm getting.
You know, there are times in life where you realize because you're interacting with somebody new that there are things that you simply take for granted. And I like to imagine that is basically Tyrion, not as if he's going to any extra effort or giving this any thought, but it's like, well, going up north, so let's load up the wine horses. And then that's just the way he lives. You know, it's just the way he lives his life. He makes an estimate. He says, I'm going to be gone about this long, so I need this many wine horses. And then he goes, doesn't give it a second thought. It's just life.
At one point he says, he calls us a curious fellowship. And I want to know, do you think that that's a wink and a nod to Lord of the Rings? He says,
you're probably right. Oh my God.
He says, there were eight in the party. There were eight in the party by then, not counting the direwolf. So in other words, he is counting the direwolf, right? Because by saying I'm not counting the direwolf. So there's eight plus the direwolf. And then later on in the, he says, it's a curious fellowship for the King's Road or any road. And I thought, oh my gosh, that's a pretty clever way to disguise it. But I think that that's a Lord of the Rings wink.
Yeah, I think I just glossed right over that. You know, I never read the Lord of the Rings, so it's not often on my mind. But yeah, I think that's deliberate. Oh, it's hilarious. I love it.
Okay, so notable introductions in this chapter. There's Jick. There's Morik. We hear about the Wolf's Wood and the mountains. We hear for the first time the names of Aegon's dragons. And maybe you could help me pronounce these correctly. So Beleriand, Meraxes, and Vhagar. Is that how I say those?
That's how you say them in the English reading of the series.
How would I say those? The names of those gods in High Valyrian?
Meraxes is the first one. And then, before getting the third one, remind me. Okay, so
it's Vhagar. Normally,
what was the second one? Was it Beleriand?
Beleriand's always the last one. Vhagar, okay. But Vhagar is Vhagar.
Okay, so yeah, Meraxes, Beleriand, and then the third one. Let's talk about this. So
that's the one I want. I was like, I'm not sure how to say this. I've got to ask David about this.
There is a tendency amongst fantasy authors to throw in meaningless consonants in places. that name in particular has given me a lot of trouble. And so the thing is, like, because you often do see H's after things, right, in various languages, but they usually mean something. So every time that we have like a PH or a TH or even a KH, right, floating around in one of our languages, they are reflective of an older sound where that made a difference, right?
Sure.
Even if it doesn't anymore. So obviously T and TH is different in English, but it's not in French, for example, where you will see TH written for words that came from Greek or Latin that had it. But it's not as if these types of things happen randomly. Okay, so it's reflective of something that actually happens in the language.
Right, like for instance, in Hebrew, before the vowelification, you'd see an H at the end of a word or a hey at the end of a word, because that was what told you to, you know, that this word is going to sound like it ends with a vowel.
That's right.
But so that's why Sarah ends with an H, for instance, right? But it seems like Martin is just throwing in H's willy-nilly.
Yes, and that's fine to do after certain consonants. It's fine to do after after stops, right? So sure. PT and K, it's fine to do that. I can resolve that as a language creator. It's even fine to do after things like nasals, which he did in Dothraki. So like you have, and after R and L, it can do things. Right. So we have this phrase, Khal-Khay-Mahar, which is K-H-A-L, K-H, it's like, sure, that's going to be kh, we can do that, that's fine. Then you have hey, R-H-A-E, and I was like, that's fine too, you can pronounce those two letters in a row. It's basically a voiceless R. And then you have mahar, M-H-A-R, so he's got three consonant H things right in a row. But you can do that. It's kind of a voiceless nasal, or you could just pronounce the two things right next to each other. That happens in Swahili. So mahad, that's fine. However, with fricatives, a fricative is a sound like s, sh,
right.
Something where there's nice air passing through. What on Earth is VH supposed to mean? It doesn't mean anything. That's not something that exists. It just doesn't exist. It doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, so, from a sort of a modern English perspective, we see consonants all the time that we don't pronounce, right?
Mm-hmm. And so you just throw it in.
Yeah, why not? Just throw it in. It'll make it look antiquated. And, you know, I'm not really concerned with how this language might have evolved over time. But that's exactly the kind of thing that you're interested in.
Yeah. And so the problem is that it only occurs in that name. It doesn't occur anywhere else. And it's not very clear what exactly the sound ought to be. However, in analyzing Valyrian, I discovered something very interesting. Just all the Valyrian names throughout this whole thing, there's no F. And there is a distinction, by the way, between things that come directly from High Valyrian and something that come from daughter languages. Huh. And you can tell. So like just looking at the word Sivas, you know that this is like Valyrian 8, like it comes from the Valyrian family, but it's not from Valyrian. And it's not. It comes from Volantis. And so that gives you an idea of what Volantine might sound like, which is great. And it also gives me something to work with when I decided, okay, what is this ultimately going to come from in High Valyrian without having to mess with its sound system? And indeed, I did. I came up with an origin for Sivas. But with this word, with Vagar, it put me in a difficult spot. Valyrian only had V. And I had, I supposed, given his George R. R. Martin's influences, I supposed that this V was going to come from something that might have been pronounced a little bit in between V and W at one point in time. So va, wa, wa, you know, something very much like that. And then later came on to be pronounced very strongly as V. What I theorized was that in some of the daughter languages, they might have developed a unique sound F that didn't exist in High Valyrian. Ah. And if you think about, High Valyrian was supposed to have a writing system, right? If you think about them trying to write this sound that has no obvious correspondence, they might say, well, let's take this thing, which is very voiceless, and put it next to this V to indicate that it's part of one and part of the other.
Right. And so it works like a PH, in other words.
Yes, and so it actually would be pronounced something like Fagar in that language. But here's the important part. As that gets reabsorbed into High Valyrian, they still don't have F, right? So sure. It's kind of like spelling something with a TH in French. They don't have a th or anything close to that. So, you know, théâtre, you know, it's just going to be pronounced like a T, even though it's going to be spelled TH. So as you bring it back to High Valyrian, it retains the spelling, but it's still just pronounced Vagar. Vagar.
Okay. All right. Now, since we're theory crafting, okay, let me throw another idea at you. You could totally reject this if you want to.
Sure, but I'll take it. I'm okay. Excited.
All right. These dragons are named after gods, right?
Yeah.
Gods are normally inherited. It's very rare to have a culture invent their own god. Mm-hmm. And so, in other words, like, you know, Rome borrowed their gods from Greek and they got new names, but not always. And the Romans borrowed their gods from the Egyptians and whatnot. What if this is a language that predates High Valyrian because it comes from some sort of dead language from whence the god came?
That is also a possibility that I would play with if it came to that.
That's a last ditch effort.
Pretty much. Like you don't want to do that too much. You don't want to do that too much because I mean, it's basically like saying a wizard did it.
It's space magic is what we're doing. So that would be the space magic analog to linguistics.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm glad. I'm glad. All right, show versus book differences. You don't get a whole lot of the road from Winterfell to the Wall in the book. A lot of the geography, a lot of Tyrion's interior world is left out. You don't get any sense that Tyrion has a rivalry with Benjen along the road, although they do bring in a sort of a hostile exchange between Tyrion and Benjen once they're at the Wall. I mean, we hear about Aegon's conquest, a little bit of his strategy, which I thought was interesting against Lauren Lannister. Did you see any notable book versus show differences when you were reading?
I will say for me, I mean, just the visual aspect was, it was so much better in the show. Just being up on the wall and seeing it and everything. I don't know. It didn't make as big an impression on me in the book. I was more focused on the characters, which sure. I honestly, that's better because it's a book. That's what it's for. And that interiority, you're not going to get that on, you know, on a show or film. Unless
yeah, you can't. You can't sort of a, same way.
You know, like an over the top monologue. What do you call it? A voiceover, which, you know.
Yeah, you can only do that too much. So that trick so much before it gets kind of old.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate your time today. Fantastic, man.
All right. Thank you for having me.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, a very special isn't your speed. We've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
Steve, this episode begins with a fart.
It does.
And it ends with a smoke baby.
It does. One and the same, and you could argue.
I think one probably foreshadows the other.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah, this episode was a lot.
It was quite a bit to talk about.
Yeah, it was an unrelenting episode, to say the least.
Should we talk about the smoke baby first?
maybe it'd be good to just get that out of the way. I mean, at this point, like, I mean, you know, we discussed the ushering in of magic, right? I mean, and mm-hmm. how I've, you know, it's a slow burn, which has been helpful for somebody like myself. You know, it's like, you know, we dragons are mentioned again, but we still don't see them, mm-hmm. you know, and it's like we've seen them a couple times. But it's brief.
Now, we've only seen a little bit of the smoke baby. Are we sure it's magic? Like, could there be a biological reason for this?
It was a lot of... It was more smoke than baby. It was... Was it a man at one point? Did it already become a smoke man?
We did see the famous graduate under the leg shot of the...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a different approach.
Instead of Dustin Hoffman, it was like a smoke man.
Yeah, the smoke man makes his way out. Yeah, I mean, yeah, so now there's just no getting around it, right? I mean,
I would say that this episode is bookended by magic. Here's why I'm going to say this.
Okay.
So the two guys that get killed at the beginning,
mm-hmm.
the flatulator and the other guy.
Right.
Right after the wolf attacks... There's a split screen. It's not there for a long period of time, but it's there. There's a split screen between Robb Stark's face and the wolf's face.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Did you ever see the show Manimal when you were a kid?
Oh, yeah. Manimal.
Manimal was a show in 1983. It only lasted one season.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a man who could turn into an animal.
Yeah, it was essentially Altered Beasts, but before the game.
Yeah, there you go. And, you know, he would turn into, like, you know, a falcon and a...
Panther, I believe, right?
A Black Panther. That's right. Mm-hmm. Odd that he was a white guy, maybe?
Sure. Odd that it existed at all. I mean, like I can't recall a single episode of Manimal. I think it was one of those things where, like, I would watch it, sort of. Because, I mean, when you're a kid, I mean, 83... Well,
yeah, in 83, we were 8 years old. Right?
Yeah, and so the idea of, like, hey, there's a show where a guy turns into an animal. And you're kind of hoping, like, well, I hope if it's an hour long, there's, like, 47 minutes of him turning into an animal. Like, mm-hmm. It's got to be constant. And instead, it was kind of like, well, you know, he's going to turn into an animal, like, maybe once. Or he will have been an animal, and then later he won't be. And you're like, well, I guess.
Well, this guy, he turned into a animal, and then he would solve crime.
Right. Well, wouldn't you if you could turn into animals?
Now, I think that George Martin was influenced by Manimal.
This is just a shot-for-shot remake of Manimal. Yeah,
that's right. And here's why. In the books, you know, we have Bran who can turn into... Like, he has these wolf dreams where he can see through his wolf's eyes, right?
Yeah.
In the books, there's a strong hint that all of these Stark children are wargs. And what that means is that they can, at will... send an astral projection of their consciousness into their wolf.
Mm.
Okay. This is not played up in the show. Basically, Bran's the only one that sort of has this ability in the show. But there are strong hints that Robb is able to spy on the enemy because he can see through the wolf's eyes.
Mm.
You see this split screen between his wolf, Grey Wind, and then Robb's face. And it's almost as if the show is bookending the magic of the wolf and the magic of the red priestess.
Smoke baby.
Yeah, smoke baby. Smoke baby. Anyway, so I thought that was interesting. I thought that was a nice, at least nod to book readers, even if they're not going to really develop the theme.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, we've talked about my feelings on magic and whatnot and how it feels like now you can do whatever you want, right?
Yeah.
That's the challenge. And my whole thing is like, I can handle a certain amount of fantasy as long as there are rules. And if you keep changing the rules as you introduce magic, it feels like there are no rules anymore.
Mm-hmm.
If you have unlimited magical abilities, I'm less inclined to be on the edge of my seat, right? I mean, it's like, well, then just magic your way out of it there, Jeff. Because, like, you know, I'm into the political intrigue. I'm in, they're like, oh, but then, by the way, there's a smoke baby now. So it's like, okay, well, you asked me the question, you know, which king do I go to? Well, you didn't tell me there was smoke babies involved, right? I mean, like, I don't know that. And so now it's like, well, now I have to change my answer.
Well, now you know.
I understand there's one area has got dragons and one got smoke babies. Another one has got remote control wolves now. And then the political theater and the jockeying for position suddenly feels moot. It's now whoever has the most magic.
Here's the thing about that. Because we see Danny at the gates of Karth, right?
Mm-hmm.
Danny's in the running for the most magical woman we've met. Right?
Sure.
All right.
Sure. Absolutely.
She's got smoke babies of her own.
Yeah. You know?
No, she's got three dragons. And yet, this does not necessarily mean that she's a powerful person. She still has to play the political game with these 13 merchants or whoever they are. And so I don't know if these are sort of meeting the criterion of rules that you're looking for here, but clearly,
well, because she's person got baby dragons.
Well, yeah, the person that doesn't have
teenage dragons.
Yeah, the person who has the most magic is not necessarily going to be the most powerful. You got to be able to know how to wield it.
You don't just have a smoke baby, and you got to do something with it, right? I mean, that's.
I never give parental advice. I've had two kids. I know how hard it is. I feel like other people's parenting styles are their own business.
Judge a mother by her smoke baby.
Who knows? I mean, next time it could just be a regular kid. It's like, I don't know. It's just
a phase. It's going through its smoke phase. If you were on the fence with Joffrey, I feel like, I mean, not that I can imagine there were a lot of people that were, but this is sort of the,
it's always the handsome ones that turn into devils.
Yeah. I mean, that's, that was bothersome. I mean, obviously
Bronn and Tyrion are really underestimating how monstrous Tyrion or, Joffrey really is.
Yeah, and so that was what I was kind of wondering too, because is Tyrion going to be taken aback? Like, oh, I had no idea he was like this. This takes me as a surprise, or was this like, okay, now I know? Like, was it with Tyrion? I feel like everything is a touch of an experiment.
Yeah, that's right. I think so.
And so it kind of feels
the
like,
way he plays Lancel's. But I mean, he plays Lancel like a fiddle.
Oh yeah, that's great.
From start to finish. Lancel's just no match.
No, not even at the end with the let's drink. Oh, you don't have a cup. He just closes the door on it. I was like, that such a mic drop moment at that point.
Okay, the Hound. There's that scene where the Hound kind of gives Joffrey a side eye.
Yeah.
And it's sort of this little glimpse that maybe he's not as amoral or immoral as Joffrey, and maybe not as loyal to Joffrey as maybe it seems. And then he's the first person to offer his cloak. So then we juxtapose that with Arya, who's got a little list. I want to talk about Arya's list.
Yeah, that list is fascinating.
All right, so here are the people on her list: Joffrey, Cersei, Illyn Payne, the Hound. Do you remember who Illyn Payne is?
I don't.
Okay.
That's where I was having a hard time.
Yeah. He's the headsman. We meet him in one of the very first episodes. He's like, he doesn't have a tongue, so he never speaks.
Mm.
And he's the one that actually takes off Ned's head.
Got it. Okay.
So,
this is her Deadpool.
This is her Deadpool. That's right. Yeah. So, and the Hound's on her list. So at the same time that we're sort of learning that the Hound is maybe more complicated,
mm-hmm.
we're also finding out that Arya wants him dead.
Yeah.
And then he ends up putting the Mountain and Polliver on her list at the end.
Right.
You know, I think there's three actors that end up playing the Mountain in the show.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. So keep an eye out for the
okay.
the rotating Mountain actors.
So is this similar to like are there Game of Thrones fans that are similar to James Bond fans who insist there's only like, oh, this was the best Mountain? No.
Oh, I'm sure that there are people that make that determination, but he's not exactly integral. Remember when they tried to swap out face with a different actor?
Yeah.
I'm talking about A-Team.
Right.
So it's one of the four main actors.
Yeah.
You can't do that.
Well, I mean, Jerry Seinfeld's dad changes from the first time we see him.
Is that right? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Huh. Okay, so that's her list. So we're going to, there's a lot made of Arya's list. We get to hear that for the first time.
So that, I mean, the assumption being that this list is like, this is keeping her alive, the idea of getting her revenge. To us. I mean, she's out there in the cold. She's laying on the ground. She's making her list. And this is.
So like that's, she's got this idea about starting to sort of thrive on the idea of revenge.
Yeah, which mirrors Rob, right? I mean, Rob is exposed for not having a grander plan.
Rob has a meet cute.
He does have a meet cute. And this meet cute is the one that sort of reveals it, like, hey, you don't wolf cage, so you unseat the king, and then what? And like,
now, that's right. Now, but meet cute, we could spell M-E-A-T.
Cause, sure, we absolutely could.
Because some guy's getting meat cut off his
butt. Yeah. Yeah, it was a relentless episode in that
regard.
Yeah,
really, it was. You have amputations going on. And he's impressed by Talisa, right? So Talisa, yeah. She's caught his eye because of the way she wields that surgical saw.
Apparently, yeah.
And what she puts to him is, well, if you don't want to be king, then you're going to throw this entire kingdom into chaos. And then you're going to go back up north. And if you don't have a plan for what happens after, then what are you thinking?
Right. I think that is an interesting way to frame it, too, because she's like, look, it'd be one thing if you had this. If I don't have to agree with the plan, but at least I could say, OK, and then you're going to rule fine, I guess. But now it's like, and then you're just going to go do it and essentially avenge your father.
Mm-hmm.
And then go back home, because even he says, well, I'll go back to Winterfell. It's like, well.
Well, and he's only ever sought counsel from people who are all in on the war idea, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is sort of the first person who's ever said, hey, maybe this is kind of a stupid idea. Maybe vengeance isn't the only reason to go to war.
You know? Right. And now he's in a spot where it's like, he's kind of pot committed to this thing. So we see the Baratheons.
Oh, yeah. The Renly and Stannis have their little parlay, right?
Right. And Renly really plays his hand about like what he sees in terms of like sort of that leadership quality. But he's that leader that's like the friendly leader. He played a lot of his hand by saying the word friends.
Yeah.
I thought that was interesting because.
Well, we have that power theme extended, right?
Right.
We've got a few different people's take. Like, a lot of these different people have a view of what power is. And for Renly, having friends and the right kind of friends is a source of power for him. And, you know. Sheer numbers. Sheer numbers are going to help him out.
And Stannis gives him an ultimatum. And did he already know Smoke Monster at this point was on the table? I mean, or does he know that he's going to have a smoke baby?
Yeah, I think he knows something weird's going to happen. I'm not.
I got the take that the priestess was like, hey, you got to get me ashore. It's all part of the plan or something along those lines.
He doesn't really want to know. He's like, Davos, you get her to shore and we're never going to speak about this again. There's a motherhood theme in this. So you got the mother dragons, right?
Mm-hmm.
Stannis says to Renly, you know, for the sake of the mother who bore us.
Right.
And then, of course, Melisandre gives birth.
Well, then you've got Baelish is appealing to motherhood.
Yes.
And once again, proving he's just a turd.
He's a turd, but boy, he's smart, man.
No, yeah, he's smart.
He doesn't quite claim to have Arya. He just says she's healthy and wild as ever, you know?
Yeah.
Just giving enough information so that he can, like, deny it later on.
Exactly.
This episode has... I think this episode departs from the book narrative more than any other I've seen so far.
Is that right?
Yeah.
What being the big difference or differences?
Well, we talked about the Joffrey scene, right?
Mm-hmm.
This does not happen in the books. In fact, Roz, the prostitute, she's not even a character in the books.
Oh, okay.
So there's that. That's kind of a pretty big deal.
That is a big... So is there another form of Joffrey demonstrating this, or is this something that they've just made a choice for the series?
So Joffrey he's older in the books.
Mm.
And there's discussion of him mutilating a cat when he's younger.
Mm-hmm.
He does sort of a lot of psychological torture with Sansa.
So as somebody who's a fan of the novel, what does this do for you from like looking at the trajectory of the character and what happens next? Does this feel, does this cheapen it? Does this add a different nuance? Does now it just feel like, okay, I'm on a different adventure altogether?
I think it's gratuitous. I think it's unnecessary. I feel like unless it's crucial for the larger statement that you're trying to make with the show, that kind of grotesque violence, specifically with underclass women, is sort of unnecessary.
Hmm.
That's my...
You feel like we have enough to go on with Joffrey as is.
I think so. It's not like there was any sort of... The jury wasn't really out on Joffrey. Like,
right.
Like, we already knew Joffrey was a monster.
Yeah.
He killed Ned, and then he forced Sansa to look at Ned's head. Integral to the plot. Integral to the plot. This is just... I feel like this is just an excuse to put more boobs on the screen and underscores Joffrey's nature, which we already knew.
Right. But in terms of what it does for the relationship with him and Tyrion...
Tyrion's treating Joffrey as if he can be distracted by his own sexuality. And what Tyrion does not know at this point is that Joffrey's a monster.
He's an absolute nightmare human.
He goes full monster.
Right. Which, you know, there's a degree of magic in that. You know, I mean, there is an otherworldly sense of, you know, like when you remove morality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's a smoke baby at this point?
In the book, she has two smoke babies.
Oh.
Yeah, like twin smoke babies.
Twin smoke babies. Yeah. That's a lot to take care of.
What do you feed a smoke baby? I'm assuming that they don't breastfeed. Only like 45-year-old men breastfeed in this show.
Yeah, pretty much. But that's the thing, is like, didn't it become a smoke man? Didn't we see smoke man legs before it?
Yeah, I guess you don't really need to suckle the baby if he just becomes a man right away.
Well, what I'm saying is now that he's a 45-year-old man, he can breastfeed because that's the rules of the show and the kingdom.
Yeah, we're talking about the rules of the show, right?
So yeah, yeah. I understand them in regards to everything. Yeah, everything ends like the grapes of wrath.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the Shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain. Featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into season two.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
In lieu of a traditional bird's eye view this week, I will include a short interview with a colleague of mine, colleague and friend named Chris Keith, who is probably the world's foremost expert on ancient book culture. He, like me, started out with religious studies, and because his research started touching on social scientific study, started being interested in other wider topics. His work in the last probably 15 years has mostly related to how ancient cultures interact with written text. And so I thought I would include a short interview with him because we meet in this chapter Tyrion, who is reading to himself silently, which struck me as very odd for an ancient culture or a medieval culture. Reading a book silently to oneself bespeaks a very elite level of education and a very strange practice. So here's my short interview with Chris Keith.
Dr. Keith.
Yes, sir.
So just for the record, I asked you to record this interview about 30 seconds ago.
Yeah, you did. Thanks for the heads up.
So I want to ask you about ancient book culture, and I'm hoping to do this in 5 minutes.
Oh, okay, yeah, sure.
Why books? Why not scrolls? What does a book do for me that a scroll doesn't do for me?
Well, a book is a scroll for ancient book culture. A book, the words, the Hebrew, Greek, and Latin words that get translated as book can mean either scroll or codex, depending on what time period you're talking about. Mm-hmm. I assume your question means, what does a codex do for you?
Yeah.
That a scroll doesn't. It depends on when you're asking. In the earliest stages, codices were regarded as less than literary forms of written communication. So think about the way that you might use a notebook in your kitchen to keep recipes, like I know you do, mm-hmm. Dr. Ladon.
I do.
And yeah. So they would be used that way. Christians were the first people to start using codices for literary works or more literary works. Initially, they were kind of workmen, but they weren't official literary products. The scroll was, and then eventually, when Christians began using codices predominantly for their texts, they still use scrolls, but they started using the codex form more than everybody else did. And then Constantine made Christianity the imperial religion. Then codices really, really took off and kind of never looked.
So
back.
Really, the really Roman culture is the rise of the codex culture.
It's really Christian dominance within Roman culture.
Okay, all right.
You know, because codices were used in Roman culture before Christians. Christians just accelerated everything in an unexpected way.
Mm-hmm. And what about tell me about the class distinctions between the kind of people that would own or commission books versus other sorts of people?
By and large, this is the biggest difference between their world and our world, is that we think of books as something that everybody has access to, at least here in the modern West, where education is publicly funded. And so literacy is the norm. In the ancient world, illiteracy was the norm. Now, people still read books, people still made books, but it really was a specialist thing. So when we think about large groups having access to the tradition in a book, we really need to think about a handful of literate people who would read aloud to the majority of illiterate people. This was true for the synagogue. It was true for a lot of the world at that time.
So someone like, I don't know, I'm thinking about like the Ethiopian eunuch who's sort of reading silently to himself.
Highly specialized skill.
Highly special. So this would be like a 1% education, elite education kind of person that would just sit and read quietly to themselves.
Yes. Yeah. There were very few people who could read at that level. They were there, and they were often in government ranks. I mean, the fact that this guy is seemingly a representative government official is not a surprise. Mm. You know, reading books at this level was almost like, and sorry, I should probably say he was probably someone who was tasked to do it for the ruler. So this was his role as a eunuch, quite possibly as a slave. The text doesn't say that, but it would not be a surprise if it was someone in servitude. And they used reading and writing of books the way that rich people today use chauffeurs.
Mm.
And they probably could read themselves like people today. Some of them could drive themselves, but mm-hmm. their ability to have somebody else do it for them is indicative of their status.
And the mystique around sort of the written word, is this something close to kind of like, I don't know, magical incantation, or is it a little bit less, is it a little bit more demystified than that?
It could be both. It was not just like magical incantation. In much of the ancient world, it was magical incantation. I mean, the written word was an important part of incantation bowls, for example. Right. There's a lot of apocropaic and magical texts that use writing in this way. And it is mysterious in some cases because, you know, most people couldn't read it. You had to be a specialist to read it. In other cases, there's a lot of places where it looks like nobody was supposed to read it. It was supposed to look like a magical language that you could that you couldn't just read under normal circumstances. So, and then in other ways, it's a way to highlight the role of an interpreter. You know, you think about the writing on the wall in Daniel. You know, it's numinous, but it's numinous in a way that requires special knowledge. So all of a sudden, the person that has that knowledge is elevated.
Right. So if you could read. If you could read an incantation, you're basically like a wizard or a magician or something.
A priest. You're a priest.
Yeah. What are these ancient codices made out of? What's the material of them?
Usually parchment, so animal skin. And there's a long process to get to make it worth that. I mean, when we're talking about the big codices, like Codex Sinaiticus or Codex Vaticanus, you could also have codices made of papyrus, which was the ancient forerunner of paper today. Most scrolls were made from papyrus, but also you have animal hide scrolls.
Yeah.
The great Isaiah scroll, for example, is animal hide.
Famously found among the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Yeah, and on display in the Book of the Shrine in Jerusalem.
And how are we binding these things? How are they bound together?
In a lot of different ways, but, you know, for a codex, you would have essentially, if you took, a sheet of 8.5 by 11 paper and then you folded it long ways, you know, you had three or four together and then you folded them long ways and then that created the spine, right? That's called a quire. And they would do that four or five or so. Actually, I don't really know how many times, but it depends on the size of the book. And then you would put those individual quires together. And then you would sew them together to create the appearance of the book. This was a highly technical and artisan task. A lot of times we think of ancient scribes as people who just wrote words on the text, and they did that. But they were also the people who had to prepare the text, line the text, measure it.
All right, man, that's it. Thanks for playing along.
Did we make 5 minutes or did we go over?
I think we went over, but I think it's okay if we went over a little bit.
All right, brother. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. So just an FYI, that's going to go out to 40,000 listeners.
Are you serious?
Yeah. On a Game of Thrones podcast that I do.
Oh, good Lord.
Well, let me ask you this. So, Chris, since you did me this favor, are there any?
We should have negotiated, man. What am I thinking?
Since you did me this last minute favor, is there anything that you'd like to draw our listeners' attention to?
My latest book is called "The Gospel as Manuscript: An Early History of the Jesus Tradition as Material Artifact." So it very much deals with all of these issues.
And that's Oxford Press?
Oxford University Press. Yeah, and also, I just had T&T Clark just issued a revised edition of book called Jesus Against the Scrabble Elite, The Origins of the Conflict.
Which is up for some kind of fancy award, I saw.
Yeah, it was nominated for an award.
Mm-hmm. Don't you get sick of winning those awards?
Well, I would if I had a podcast that had 40,000 listeners, but I don't. So I cling to my meager accomplishment.
All right. So I appreciate that. I was thinking, you know, I should say something about ancient book culture, but I said, you know, if I do that, I'm just going to be plagiarizing Chris. I was thinking, you know, if he's got 5 minutes, I should just twist his arm and get him on and record him talking for 5 minutes about book culture.
Oh, man. Well, I appreciate it.
I really appreciate it.
All right, buddy. Let me know when it goes live.
I will let you know. Thanks, man. Mm-hmm.